Our second cast executive director is here now to speak to us, Randy Isaacs. And he's going to be talking on information and misinformation in life's origins.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to spend a few minutes here this afternoon talking about information and misinformation as it applies to life's origins. And you won't get biology or chemistry here as much as more physics and information. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the definition. What is information? How does it apply to biology? Then I'm going to look at a couple of common intelligent design claims of information. Take a look at that. And finally, what does all this have to do with the origins of life? So first of all, we have to figure out what is information. And I dare say that very few of you, except for Lauren and a few others, would expect this definition. Anything that could be different. James Gleick, in his classic, The Information, A History of Theory of Flood, gives credit to 375 years ago when Vicar John Wilkins said, "Whatever is capable of a competent difference, perceptible to any sense, may be a sufficient means whereby to express the cogitations." That means you take a quarter, and no, Steve, I'm not going to use four, just one. Take a coin, you toss it. Heads and tails have a competent difference. They are perceptible to any sense. You have information. Okay? So what you really need to remember from this slide is information is physical, relates to physical states, differentiable, discernible physical states. What really makes information so fascinating, so powerful, is that these physical states are isomorphic. What does that mean? It means that the information, even though it depends on the physical state, is independent of which physical state you use. What does that mean? Well, I'm talking, and the information of my words are in acoustical sound waves. They get to the recorder. They're transferred to electrons. The electrons get transferred into whatever storage device is in there. Later, those bits are transferred to another electrical signal, which goes to a speaker, and recreated into acoustic sound waves. Notice how the information remained constant and was transformed from one physical state to another. So the information is independent of its physical state, even though it's physical. Now, what happened is in the 1940s, the communication industry realized that it was possible to quantify information simply by counting how many discernible physical states you had in your system, and that it turned out to be the log base 2 of n bits. You don't have to be base 2. You can do any bit, any kind of base you want. If you use natural log, then it'd be nits instead of bits. But that's a simple way of doing it. And then Claude Shannon, in 1948, published his immense seminal paper where he generalized it, showed how to include noise, and I'm not going to bother with all of that. But the fundamental equation was then generalized to this form. Now, relax, you don't have to remember these equations. You won't see another equation here today. The only two things I'd like you to remember off of this slide is, first of all, there is a mathematical formalism to information theory with the associated rigor and universal principles. Secondly, how many of you recognize this from your physics thermodynamics class? You put Boltzmann's constants in front of it, and you have Clausius' equation for the thermodynamic entropy. And that's really why Claude Shannon labeled this informational entropy. Okay. Now, remember that, because we're going to talk later about the little connection here. Now, there's so many different types of information. We could take a year in going through it. I'll just pick one or two different examples. First of all, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes on analog versus digital information. The macroscopic world that you and I live in is really analog information. You know, the sound waves, you know, have continuous variables in the amplitude and frequency of the sound you hear, the electromagnetic waves, the light, continuous variables in amplitude and frequency, the pressure, the temperature, everything we deal with are continuous variables. Whereas the microscopic world is really digital. Why? Because atoms, for one reason, atoms and molecules come in discrete integral units. You don't have half an atom or half a molecule. More importantly, quantum mechanics, the solution to Schrodinger's equation, is a set of discrete quantized states. So the microscopic world is digital. This is why some of the earliest computers were built with analog computers. So why didn't they survive? Why don't we have analog computers today? Well, it's very simple, because if you look at this kind of situation, if you have a tiny bit of noise, how are you going to tell the difference between signal plus noise versus signal? You can't. So after a little bit of processing, the noise will dominate and you're gone. And digital, it's a little bit different. This is an oversimplified case. We usually use zeros and ones. Well, if your signal comes in at 1.1, so hey, that's not valid. We know it's got to be one, so you can throw away the noise if it's not too big. You throw away the noise, and so you have an error correction that's built in every step. So what does this mean? This means that even though the macroscopic world we want to deal with is analog, it means digital world's what you want if you want memory, if you want to store things, if you want to copy things, if you want to transmit things. You need digital, because that's where you really can correct your errors. But if you want to be adaptive to the real world and interface with the real world, you have to be analog. And that's why today's digital computers are all digital, but we continually make the transition from analog to digital and back to analog. And in fact, about a third of the semiconductor industry is analog mixed signal, and probably always will be. Okay, so remember this. We'll come back to digital analog a little bit later. But first, I want to give you my hierarchy of categories of information. And you've probably read this in my paper, but let's try it again. I like to start at the fundamental level of the hierarchy with thermodynamics. Why? As information theorist Benjamin Schumacher once said, thermodynamics is where the laws of nature meet information theory. It all comes together, and there's a profound connection between the two. Right? So those equations were the same, as I told you before. And here, from an information point of view, you're really referring to all possible physical states. But this is purely useless. Only physicists or engineers will even care about this. Nobody else cares at all. So you can't deal with that. So we have to do, and this is not the scale. This may be 1 over 10 to the 150th or something. But if you want to talk about information, you have to decide what subset are you going to work with. You may decide, I'll work with a series of quarters, or I'm going to work with a series of light switches, or I'm going to work with a terabyte of a memory stick, so something like that. And then you have to impose upon that a level of syntax. What are the actual states, and what is the grammar that you're talking about? And finally, this is the only thing all of you are interested in. You don't care about the rest, the semantics. What does it mean? What's on sale at Walmart? You know, what's the score of the Red Sox game? You know, these are important things. That's what we care about. But as Claude Shannon pointed out, information theory, or Shannon information, meaning is of no interest to the engineer. So the semantics is outside of information theory. Now, if you think about it, you can't really quantify meaning, and meaning is dependent upon context. Let me give you an example so it can help you understand what this hierarchy means. Okay? Let's take a linguistic example. The analog to the thermodynamics level may be the set of all languages, from smoke signals to raised eyebrows to you name it, you know, whatever way you want to communicate. Well, that's a Tower of Babel. And to make sense, you have to pick one. Pick some system of communication, which is analogous to that. And within that language, you have a structure, vocabulary, grammar, etc. And that's all within the bounds of information theory. But then you have meaning. Okay? Different sequences of the alphabet and the words have different meanings. But you can't write an equation for that. Try thinking of an equation for how many words have meaning. You know, you can't do that. The formalism doesn't extend to that point, right? And, of course, you understand the context here. Words have different meanings depending upon their context. So let's figure out, how does that apply to biology? Well, I would suggest that here's the biological version of that. You might say that the analog to thermodynamics, maybe an entire microbiome, are all possible biomolecules. again, totally useless. I mean, it's so many that even biochemists get blown away with that. So you have to pick what's your subset that you're going to deal with. And most commonly, we talk about the genome, although as you'll see soon, there's a lot of other information there. But you got to pick one to work with. And the genetic code is the syntax, you know, that really allows meaning to be applied to the genome. Then finally, the semantics version is very interesting. This is the biochemical action, the process that emanates from that particular genetic code. Now, the term bioinformatics typically deals with a whole set. Biological information can be ambiguous, and it's careful to define that, whoever uses it. And I appreciate the fact that the intelligent design community is usually very good about being clear that when they talk about biological information, they're not talking about Shannon information. They're talking about biochemical action. They're talking about not just any biochemical action, but that biochemical action which is useful and necessary for life. Okay, so that's a subset. So you'll see in some of their books called biological information, and they're careful to discuss that a little bit. Now, just a little side note again, what I find very interesting in terms of biological information. Again, digital versus analog. Remember, we talked about that a little bit. And what you have in biology, you have two sets of alphabets. You know, one is the four-letter alphabet that we are all familiar with in terms of DNA, and a very slightly different one for RNA. And then a more complex 20-letter alphabet for proteins, which is a set of amino acids here. So these are digital-based, two different digital-based information systems. But to interact with the real world, where you need analog information, the key part is that the string of amino acids specified by this sequence folds into a complex function, and the shape is an analog shape, really. Like here, for example, is an antibody, and here's an antigen. It's the shape that's so critical, and it comes in many ways. And this is how you adapt to the real world. And this is how you're sensitive to environmental conditions, because the folding often depends upon the temperature, depends on the pH, depends upon the environment, depends upon a lot of different things. So you can see that the actual usefulness of biological information here depends a lot on the context, and there's actually a very small degree of reverse kind of information in the sense that different shapes can alter the way in which some of the digital pieces are expressed. There's a lot of complex interaction going on. There's an enormous amount of biological information here that's greater than simply the number of possible sequences that you can get. It's truly a fascinating system, and there's enough to study here for many, many decades to come. All right. Now, I told you I wanted to specifically consider two claims that are common in the intelligent design community that have been around for about 25, almost 30 years or so. And they were summarized last October in a video that Steve Meyer and Doug X put together called Information Enigma. How many of you have seen that? Yeah, Perry, you know it. Nobody else? It was circulated widely for 9 months. I would have thought most of you knew it. Anyway, let me take a look at the two claims that they used there, which were not new. I mean, they summarized what was there. The first one is that new information can only be generated by an intelligent agent. And sometimes there are variations, but sometimes it's called the law of conservation of information. And essentially, what they say, why should this be true? And lots of different justifications, but one of the most common expressions is that, well, all our experience shows that information is always generated by a conscious mind. Now, in my opinion, and you're free to differ here, but I believe it is false when you apply it to biology. Okay, why? Well, all that experience that's used as evidence here is really on human designed information systems. Take a look. Go through all the literature and see what's there. It's the communication, which is a fantastic base, communication, the telephone systems, the math, the computers, you name it. Okay, the experiences that are brought forward are all human-designed systems. And what's unique about those? Well, human-designed systems, you can imagine, are specifically designed so that nature can't give you noise, you know, so that it does take a human. And also, it means that often with human design systems, there's an abstract relationship. Remember we talked about meaning? There's a symbolic meaning connected with most of them. Why does this shape mean a two? That's an abstract relationship. There's nothing about nature. So nature couldn't know that this shape means the number two. It takes an intelligent design. And, as I pointed out before, that meaningful DNA information is all biochemical action. It's not an abstract relation. You don't have to recognize a particular shape as meaning two unless there's an actual physical implication of that particular shape. So what you have is that the analog information in a protein, it's the physical chemical action from the shape of that protein that really causes the information. It's not some abstract meaning that has been given to it by an external agent. And finally, I would say, hey, it happens all the time. Every reproductive event has new information. Now, the standard ID claim here is, no, this isn't new because it existed in the parents. Well, think about the definition of information. You know, anytime you change a physical state, it makes it different. You've got different information. And as you know, every genetic sequence of the offspring differs from the parent. It's not the same. So it is always new. Now, usually the response to this is, well, yeah, but what we really mean by information here is not just any information, but very specific, functional, useful, complex, specified, whatever adjective you want to put here. And that leads us to claim number two, which is that the probability of information being functional or meaningful or useful or valuable or whatever, or complex or specified, is just too small to be attained without intelligent agent. There's no way in which you could pick it out unless you knew what you were doing. And we see many papers coming out saying that meaningful information is rare. And I fully agree. It is extremely rare. But rarity doesn't mean it's not abundant. Okay, rare is relative to all the possibilities. There still is a very large number of possibilities. Now, what Steve and Doug do in that video is to use a bicycle lock analogy. So let's take a look at the bike lock. I think most of you have used a bike lock, and here's a simple one where you've got four rings, and each one can have a value, and if you pick the right value, you've got it together. So there are 10,000 combinations. So if you want to open it, you either have to know what it is or you have to go through all 10,000 to try to figure out what it is. So if you look at that, you see that this approach scales exponentially, where P is the number of settings that you can have on each ring, and N is the number of rings that you have. The number of attempts that you need scales as P to the N. And in exponential scaling, you know you very quickly get so many zeros you can't put them on a screen. And if you then think of proteins as long chains of amino acids, so you have 20 amino acids for P and N, it'd be what? Anywhere. I think the shortest little element is like 120 or so amino acids. And they can be, what, 10,000 or more. But I don't care what your numbers pick. You can easily show that this probability is just extraordinary. I mean, it's off the charts. It doesn't work. All right, so that sounds pretty convincing to most people. Except there's a minor problem. In my opinion, this claim is not valid. Why? Because it doesn't apply to biology. I have yet to see, and I don't think any biochemist has ever identified a biological process that is close to being an analogy to a bike lock. Biology just doesn't work that way. There is no case where you make a protein by throwing amino acids together. Well, if it doesn't do that, what does it do? How does biology work, and what are its analogies? Well, let's figure this out. And let's kind of use that bike lock example again. Instead of throwing it out, let's take another look at it. This time, instead of just trying it randomly, let's figure out how to pick a lock. What does a lock picker do? Well, you're not going to try 10 to the fourth things. That's crazy. The cops will come long before you get there. So what you do is you start with a random code. And then, if you're expert enough and know how to do it, you determine if any of those is correct. How can you do that? Well, the standard lock pickers like Richard Feynman and so on, you've trained yourself to be able to either listen or to feel. You can't do it on every bike lock, and I sure can't do that. But there are locks where you can feel, if you're experienced in it, what the right settings are. Then if you find that, hey, one or maybe two of your random code are correct, hey, that's cool. Then you retain the correct one and you vary the others. Now, it turns out, and this was a big surprise to me a few years ago, that if you do that, the scaling is not exponential, it's logarithmic. Now, I didn't believe it when I read a paper that claimed this, and I couldn't understand what they were saying, so I had to derive it myself. And yeah, it actually does turn out that way. And here's a basic principle that basically says if there's a way to retain functional information, the useful parts of it, then you can generate new functional information very quickly that really picks the lock. Okay? Now, that's a result that I first learned from a clever little article by two mathematicians, Wolf and Ewens, back in December of 2010. And they're the ones who derived it and had a hard time doing it. And they applied it to evolution. This paper by Wolf and Ewens was scathingly criticized in the Evolution News blog. And the critic pointed out that their description of evolution was not accurate. That's true. Okay, it wasn't precise. But I think the critic missed the most important part. You don't have to accurately describe evolution here. You don't have to be perfect in terms of identifying the correct information and varying the rest. Turns out, when you're talking about going from exponential to, I'm going ahead of myself here. If you're going from exponential to logarithmic, just put in the numbers, this is huge. You don't have to get that far off. You can make partial progress and still get away from this improbable statistic. It's just huge, and it's a very relevant piece. So now, what do we say? How does this all apply to origin of life and to biology? How does this come to being? Well, I would suggest that this principle of identifying and retaining functional information is a fundamental process of biology, okay? And life itself depends on retaining functional information. How does biology do that? It's the most common process you all know about. Reproduction. In other words, you're starting with a successful point and going from there. You don't do that in a bike lock. You don't start with a successful solution. You don't have, you only have one answer. In biology, you've got a lot of functional answers. You're starting with one that's already known to be functional. And if you don't change anything, hey, and the environment doesn't change, you're okay. So biology identifies it because it starts with it and just makes tiny changes of it. Furthermore, it uses large populations. It's not a serial process, it's a massively parallel system. Why is that important? If it's serial, then if you guess wrong, you've erased your entire history and your knowledge that you've built up in terms of the successful path. But if you've got a large population, half of them fail, so what? You still retain what is successful and you've filtered it, and you're using that as your next base. And I would assert, without proof, I understand, I would assert that this kind of process is not just in biology, but goes back to chemical evolution and is a powerful piece in the origin of life, because natural selection, as well as other selection techniques, work at the information level as well, not just in organisms. And I would suggest that there, in my opinion, there is no support for an inference to intelligent design from the field of information. Thank you.
Do we have time for questions? Please stand up and speak up.
So, excellent talk. I'm curious if you've thought about at all John Lennox's version of this,
yes,
where he looks at compressibility.
Yep.
And kind of, I mean, it's similar, but I'm wondering if you could just comment on that.
Well, compressibility is extremely important, of course, for every communications engineer. And I'd love to go on. There was a comment earlier about compressibility and information content, and that would be a fun discussion to have, because it really has to do with what is the minimum amount of bits necessary to transmit a particular message, and that's where Shannon's theory comes all in, and you work about all that through. So there is a notion in which compressibility is there. Now, in terms of how Lennox applies it, I'll just be honest and say it didn't do much for me. I didn't see how it really changed factors very much. So yeah, there's compressibility, but the compressibility is important in how we describe the information, right? And of course, you can see a lot of different algorithms in terms of how gene splicing is concerned, and there's a lot of processes that go on that are fascinating, analogous to the way in which we do things. But to me, it doesn't say much in terms of intelligent participation. I don't see that. Yes, Jonas.
So are you familiar with John Sanford's work, a book that's called Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome?
I haven't read it.
Okay, so he basically attacks this idea of natural selection, and his main argument is that the phenotype that determines the ability to reproduce is very, very far removed from the genes that is the thing that's being manipulated. And so I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, going only on the comments you made, it sounds to me as if they're doing something that I think is a common error, and that is assuming that you have to have the complete kind of cycle in the cell that does modern day processing. And for that, you need all of it together. And if you extrapolate backwards, you don't need all that. I mean, replication works at the very small molecular level as well, by simple replication. You don't need the entire complexity of DNA and all your enzymes to do basic elementary replication. So the principles of replication in a large concentration population, they're independent of that complexity, and it works all the way back to the chemical level. I mean, those are trivial. They're not very complex, I understand, but you can grow crystals. I mean, look at that. You're replicating a particular structure. That's the simplest version. You can't get much out of it, but as you grow more complex, you can see how it all works. So I think that's a common myth in the issue of, if I've understood it correctly.
Thanks, Randy. I was wondering if you had put any thought into the role epigenetics may play in
yes.
information, especially in the context of imprinting where the mom and dad's genome is completely wiped clean before the new sets are reset.
Yes.
So in terms of reproduction and
say you're absolutely right, and I kind of took those slides out because that's another whole dimension added to it, and I kind of washed it away here in this mix from digital to analog information, and the whole epigenome is all consumed in that because you get the impact of your histones that are acetylated or whatever, and it really changes the shape, you know, at the microscopic level of each little histone, and that change in shape pulls the DNA segments together or farther apart. That influences expression. That influences its function. And so, yeah, you're going to have a hard time writing down an equation for this, you know, because it's really beyond that mathematical structure. So in principle, it's all there. In other words, the information is vastly greater than the huge amount of just the sequence of the DNA. The sequence of the DNA, and I think that's another reason why personalized medicine is going to be a problem, because the sequence is just a starting point. And it really isn't enough to tell you what's going on in the big picture.
A couple more quick questions.
So I have a question with regards to this notion of new information being created. Mm-hmm. You start out by saying it has to be meaningful. It has to have some functional effect, which in a sense is an externally imposed concept into this. You take the state space and you decide these states are better than those, and you impose some sort of fitness function on that state space. So couldn't it be argued that you're just transferring information from this fitness function that you impose on a state space into your code, be it the genetic code or any other code, you're just converging to something that you defined is what you want. But that definition was external to the system.
Well, that's
so is information really created or just transferred?
Well, both, right? And part of it is, I think you're right, because there's a top-down kind of structure that filters and influences the whole information selection process. So in many cases, yes, we define the criteria of what we want. In nature, we don't need to define it, and we don't define it. Nature defines it itself because survival and reproduction is the process, and that you can call that an external piece, but it's not by an external intelligent agent at all. It's kind of a self-defined system. By definition, if it doesn't survive, it no longer exists. You know, so yes, that is a top-down kind of influence on the bottom-up effect from the information.
One more question.
So are you going backwards, or are you going back to Howard Van Til's functional integrity principle in terms of the source of, you know, if we do assume that God is the source of information, genetic information in particular, is that where we would end up in terms of how to now apply this to the complex question of, is God involved in the origin of life?
I greatly appreciate Howard Van Til, and he influenced me a lot. Not as much as Dick Bube, but still, he is very popular. However, I think his concept of the robust formational economy, or whatever it was still missing something. And so the own directions that I'm kind of reading and trying to think about is really emergence and where you get a lot of causation effects from emergence, and very similar to what Bill Newsom was talking about last night, and to some extent Reed picked up this morning. There really is, out of the interaction of a complex ensemble with dynamic interaction, you get entities that in turn have a top-down causation on the molecular level. So I don't think Van Til incorporated any of that. So I'm kind of partially going there, but I think we have to go beyond that.
Okay, these discussions can continue over the break. We have a break coming up, but let's thank our speaker.